Hi, everybody, and welcome to Stack Trace, the podcast that is about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are me, John Sandell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm good, John. How are you? I imagine things are not quite as well there in your part of the world.
Yeah, things are really, really disturbing here at the moment. I am safe. I'm doing well here in Poland, but I am very, very concerned, upset, terrified, angry, saddened, lots of emotions and adjectives about the situation and the war that is currently going on in our neighbor country of Ukraine. And even though this is a podcast about, you know, life and technology, we're almost always focused on programming, on Apple things, on technology. But every once in a while, we do have to acknowledge things that are happening outside of that world, even though we usually are privileged and we have the luxury of being able to focus on, you know, our jobs and focus on the code that we write and things like that. But right now, the situation that's going on in Ukraine and Russia's really senseless, brutal attack on the country and its people really deserves our attention. And I am, very, very personally kind of upset and affected, even though I'm not affected by the war here, but I have so many friends who I know who are living there in Ukraine who are affected, and it's just really a horrible situation, and I really condemn what's happening there. I am against war in all shapes and forms. I don't think anyone deserves to be affected by war. I think it's always horrible, no matter where it happens, but yeah, right now I'm thinking a lot about my Ukrainian friends, thinking a lot about the Ukrainian people, and really believe that they deserve all the support that we can give them.
Yeah, I totally agree. And even being as far as I am from all of this and not knowing personally anyone in the country as you do, I can only imagine how you must feel about it. So I totally agree with everything that you said.
Yeah, and we're going to move on with the show now. We're going to talk about, you know, programming. We're going to talk about Swift UI and home automation and all sorts of things. But I just wanted to start by just talking a little bit about this, just because I think it's, again, important to kind of acknowledge these things, like big world events when they happen. And again, it's not to diminish any other horrible things that happen around the world. Unfortunately, the world we live in, horrible things happen in so many different parts of the world, and it's really terrible when these things do happen. But yeah, just this one in particular, since it's happening like right next to where I live, and since it's affecting personal friends of mine, it's really something that I'm very, very focused on right now. So haven't had that much focus to focus on work during the past week, but still gonna share some updates from my end.
So speaking of work, what have you been doing while you were coding?
So I wrote an article about a week ago or something like that now about unit testing Swift UI based views.
Yes.
And this is something that I know a lot of people have asked me about. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the community around how can we unit test our code now that we're moving towards Swift UI kind of as a community, and more developers are starting to write their views in Swift UI. Because kind of the challenge with Swift UI, since it's so declarative, since it's so dependent on the system, like the system takes over the actual rendering of your views and you are kind of just declaring what you want to render, that has a lot of advantages. And we've talked about them in the past, how productive we sometimes feel with Swift UI, and that sometimes you can, you know, build really views really, really quickly with it. But when it comes to unit testing, it can be a bit challenging, because if your logic is within those kind of Swift UI view declarations, then that's going to be really, really hard to unit test, because you don't have control over the actual evaluation of that logic. It all happens kind of based on when the system accesses your view body, when it performs the rendering, when it calls your appear functions, and so on. So how can you kind of unit test that? And in the article that I wrote, which we'll leave a link to in the show notes, one of the main things I kind of brought up there was, I think what our goal should be when we're working with these kind of UI frameworks, regardless if they are declarative or not, regardless if it's Swift UI or UIKit, I think the kind of good approach, if you want to write really testable code, is to try to move your own personal logic, that is like your quote-unquote business logic, away from your views. And this is something that you hear people talk about all the time, like when this is not original advice, right? I'm not the first person to say this. It's kind of a common architectural principle that you don't want to have your business logic in your UI code. But I think when we're working on apps that are UI-based, it can sometimes be really tricky to decide like where to put this kind of code, because the natural place to put a lot of our view-related logic might actually be in our views, right? Yeah. Like if you're running something after your view has appeared, the most natural place to put that code might just be in that appear closure in your Swift UI view, because that's kind of where it's being triggered. So in the article, I wrote about a few techniques that I like to use to kind of do that actual move to take the logic and move it out of views. And one of the primary things is just to kind of try to create some object that is not actually associated with Swift UI. For example, it can be a view model or a controller or things like that. And then use that in your Swift UI view. But it also doesn't have to be that kind of heavyweight. Like creating a view model for every single one of your Swift UI views can be quite a lot of extra work. And sometimes it can feel a bit unnecessary. Like if you have a view that only needs to perform like a couple of different pieces of logic, maybe it needs to just make a quick network call and maybe render that. Maybe there's one piece of user interaction to then do another network call or something. Like, do you really need a view model for that? And some people would say, yes, you do. You should always have a view model, MVVM for life, right?
Yeah.
But I'm not one of those people. Like, I always think that architecture needs to be pragmatic and that it should solve concrete problems. And sometimes you might choose to adopt something, some kind of pattern for kind of some kind of uniformity where you're in a maybe larger team and you want to make sure that the code base is consistent. So you say, okay, let's just make one view model for every view. And I can understand that. That's fine. But in other kinds of contexts that, you know, a lot of people work in when you're maybe in a smaller team or maybe working by yourself or something like that, I think you can sometimes just make that decision on a view by view basis and say, this view is a little bit more complicated, so it should have its own controller or its own view model. But this view is not that complicated. So what I can just do, I can just write a couple of extensions on my model type, and then that's what my view will call. And then I can just unit test those. And that's kind of the point that I was trying to make there in the article, is that it's not to say that you need to create a view model for every view unless you really want to. It's just about finding different ways to extract your logic out from your views in ways that kind of feel natural, doesn't add a lot of extra boilerplate, a lot of extra abstractions, but still gives you that testability while still keeping your view code very simple.
Yeah, I think one of the big things here, and something I've been trying to do, I've been writing a lot of Swift UI lately, not only for prototyping, but I've actually started writing some production Swift UI that's going to go into production in Airbuddy soon. And I can't wait to be able to talk more about what I've been cooking there. And I think the thing I've been trying to understand about the code that I'm writing is the difference between view state logic and actual business logic.
Right.
I think there's a significant difference about that. So I'm really fine with keeping anything that has to do with just the view's current state in the view itself. So like when I'm writing a Swift UI view where you can pinch to zoom or do something along those lines, it's fine for all of that logic to be within the view itself, unless it's actually manipulating an underlying model, then I think in that case you might want to think about it. But if it's just view state, I'm fine with leaving it within the view itself. It's when it starts touching especially persistent states and user data and things like that, where it really becomes more like business logic. That sort of thing is the sort of thing that you might want to write tests for. And even though I'm not as proficient in unit testing and I'm not as prolific in unit testing as you are and as some other developers are, I do try to keep things in a way where if I do want to write tests for them, I can. And that's when I try to rely more on simple objects that just do the business logic and then a view model that connects to them, or just a view model itself or something that plays that role. In practice, I usually actually don't have that much actual business logic in view models. The actual business logic is usually something that's behind the view model, and it's the thing that the view model talks to. But again, it hugely depends on the complexity of what I'm working with. If it's something simple, Many times I won't even have something like a view model. If it's a little bit more complicated, then I will have a view model probably. And if it's something really complex and with lots of details in business logic and storage and things like that, then I will definitely have a view model or a controller and something else that's managing that underlying data for the view model itself. I really like this approach, and I think it lends itself well to unit testing while at the same time keeping things flexible and not too complicated to figure out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that can be really useful to do, even if you're working in a slightly larger team and you have more of those requirements around like having things be a little bit more consistent, because if you just give people very loose rules and no particular guidelines, then things can turn quite chaotic quite quickly, right? It's like, yeah, if every developer writes the code in a team their own way with no kind of regard to what the other people are doing, then that's usually a recipe for very unmaintainable code. But having some kind of scalable approach, like you just mentioned, where you basically have different tiers, where you say, this kind of view, we want to architect it like this. This other kind of view, which is slightly more complex, we want to architect it like this. And it can be something like you said, where if it's a simple component, like a button or some kind of header view or something like this, then doesn't need any view model or anything like that. We just keep it just as a view and you just feed it the data it needs and that's it, right? And then we try to keep the logic in, like that is in the view, as absolutely simple as possible. But then if you move kind of one step up from there and you have a component or a view that is a little bit more complex, maybe it's like one screen of the app or something like that, then you want to introduce this kind of object. Let's say a view model or a controller or a presenter or whatever you want to call it, coordinator. And then you move one step up from that and say, here's like a really complex screen. Let's say you have some kind of like a e-commerce app or like product-based app, and you have your purchase screen, for example. It might have like a lot of business logic, a lot of requirements and things like that. Then you might choose to say, well, then we're going to architect it with these kind of underlying services, and it's going to have this interface here and this view model here. And you kind of build up this kind of scalable guidelines that is like for different tiers of different views in your application. I think that is something that can work really, really well and can work for both like an indie developer, a small team, and a larger team as well. I think it's all about like trying to be pragmatic no matter what level you need to work at. And I think sometimes we're very tempted to try to find simple solutions to complex problems where, you know, like we like to joke about on the show is like the whole it depends thing, right? Like, yeah, when people just want to say, what's the best way to do X? And usually it's just, it depends. But I think if you create like tiers like that and different alternatives for different types of situations, and you create examples like, here's when the type of situation we want to use this architecture or that architecture, and they can all connect together, I think that's something that can strike a really nice balance between structure and pragmatism.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And something else to be careful about when working with SwiftUI, and it's something I noticed me doing, is to be careful about environment objects and how far down the view tree they go. And my policy that I've established in order to keep myself on check with that regard is not letting my environment objects, so like the controller, the master controller, the main controller, the view model that handles a huge view tree, not let it arrive at the leaf nodes, basically. So you can have it in, say you have a view that has like a header and then a list of things, and then within the list you have each item on the list. I can let my view model get to the list and the header, but not to the list item view, for instance.
Right.
I think that's a way to not also propagate your state too much down the view hierarchy, where you start having problems with things manipulating the shared state in unpredictable ways and causing weird and untraceable bugs.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why we're so often pointing out the whole kind of separation of concerns thing. It's not just about code structure, but it's also a lot about data flows and how to create predictable data flows, because usually the bugs you get in an application are usually around, like you said, like unpredictable ways that state is mutated or data is flowing in an application. And not only can it cause bugs, but it can also make things very hard to debug. If you have like this one object that you're just passing around a whole view hierarchy, then when that object changes, like when you need to trace like where's this change coming from, that can also be tricky if it's happening in too many places. While if you have these very clear kind of ways that data flows and events are propagated, then that's usually a lot easier to manage. And this is where we have to remember, again, that it doesn't have to be like one size fits all. Just because you like to use observable objects and view models or something doesn't mean that that needs to be the only metaphor you use. Like, I tried to make use of the entire SwiftUI toolbox, like bindings and state and closures and all sorts of things that let me do those things. Like, if I just want to inject a value in order for it to be mutated by, let's say, some kind of text field, I don't need to inject an observable object there. I can just inject a binding to that string. And the cool thing is you can so easily convert between these things. Like, if you have a observable object which has a published property, you can convert that into a binding using the standard dollar syntax inside of your view. So if you have like a view model that has a text property, you can just say dollar view model.text, and that becomes a binding to that string property. So SwiftUI gives you so many tools that lets us do those kinds of conversions and lets us decide on a kind of view-by-view basis how we want to propagate our state. So I think that's a big part of the SwiftUI learning curve and an important thing to focus on, I think, as you're kind of, you know, learning the framework and starting to make use of it, is, you know, really trying to focus on those different state management mechanisms and how you can make the best use of each, rather than just saying, like, let's just use view models or observable objects everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. The way SwiftUI manages state for you and keeps things in sync for you can be both a blessing and a curse sometimes. And most of the bugs that I see in terms of data flow, not talking about like layout bugs and system integration bugs that many people tend to complain about with SwiftUI, but the actual source of truth and data type bugs that I see in my SwiftUI code is related to propagation of state where the state should not be propagated, basically. So basically too much of a good thing. So what SwiftUI solves is, if you're writing your app in an imperative way, like with AppKit or UIKit, you have to take care of keeping your view state in sync with the underlying data. With SwiftUI, it takes care of that for you. But if you get too much of that, you end up in some situations where, well, actually, in this case, the view showing exactly what the underlying data model is not the thing I wanted. And the best solution that I found for that in more complex situations, not in like a simple thing where it's just, oh, binding this text field directly to the view model causes some issues. So in that case, you can just have like a separate state and propagate that to the view model separately somehow. But when you have more complex situations, the best solution I found for that was to introduce another model that fits between the actual underlying view model and what's on screen, which filters the propagation of state between the view and the model and vice versa.
So you're saying you're creating a view model?
Yeah, I'm creating a view model. View model model?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, but I think you're hitting an important point there, is that, you know, data also has a hierarchy usually. Just like how our views have hierarchies, data also has that as well. Like, sometimes you want to only access a subset of your data in a particular view, and sometimes you want the view maybe to be read-only for that data. Sometimes you want it to be mutable. Sometimes you want it to have more access to like the wider kind of memory graph or data graph of your application. And I think it's also important to sometimes create those tailored models, even if it can sometimes feel a little bit like code duplication if you have like the same almost model in two places, but just slightly different depending on what you need to show. That can still sometimes be worth it, because then you, again, create that predictable data flow, and you know that if I'm in this view has access to this particular data. Maybe in view A, one property is optional, but in view B, it's not. Like, maybe you are in one view, you have an optional user, but then in the then you ask the user to log in, and then the second view, the user is not optional anymore. It might just be worth to create a separate version of that model that has that non-optional user, just because then you're sure that when I arrive at this view, then I know that this data is here. And I've talked about this many times before.
Locks and keys.
Yeah, there you go. It keeps coming back. But I think it's important, right? Like, to have that kind of separation for the data and to know the properties are there. Because if you start like force unwrapping and start making up assumptions about, you know, all this data will definitely be here, then you change things somewhere else, and then that assumption no longer holds true anymore. So I think the more we can help get the type system to kind of help us out here, the better.
Yeah, hierarchy is important, people. It's all just a bunch of trees.
That's right. It's all just a bunch of trees. This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by Sentry. Sentry helps iOS developers monitor the performance of their code. With Sentry, you can quickly identify performance issues. And whenever an issue was detected, then you will get the full end-to-end distributed trace info so that you can see exactly where a poor performing API call was made and what caused it. With Sentry, you can detect and measure anything from both cold and warm app launches, slow frame rendering, freezes, and other UI glitches, and much more, so that you can then improve your mobile app's performance for maximum efficiency without requiring maximum effort from you and your team. So head over to sentry.io/4/iOS, or just use the link that's in the show notes to help support this podcast and to try Sentry for free for your iOS app. And if you use our special promo code STACKTRACE during signup, then you will get to use Sentry for free for 3 whole months. Once again, that's sentry.io/4/iOS, or just use the link that's in the show notes, and remember to use that offer code STACKTRACE when signing up for that special 3-month offer. Thanks a lot to Sentry for sponsoring this episode of Stack Trace. All right, Rambo, so this turned into a fun little another accidental deep dive into architecture and Swift UI. It seems like, you know, we sometimes have in our show notes here quick update about Swift UI, you know, but it's never a quick update. It always turns into something more complex, but that's always fun to talk about. But now I want to hear, what have you been up to?
So a bit of a different update. I've been on vacation for a while, so I've just gotten back to my coding duties. But over the weekend, what I've been doing is I've been changing some stuff about my home automation setup, and I think this can lead into an interesting deep dive, maybe.
All right. Yeah. So tell us more.
Sure. So as we talked about before, my whole apartment here, after I bought it and got it renovated, I decided to have all the things automated. Not all the things, but lots of things automated. And the way things are here, so the ceiling lights in most rooms are those spotlights embedded into the ceiling, basically. So it's not like a format where I can just like grab a Philips Hue lamp and put it in there. And even if I could, I am not particularly fond of the max brightness of the Philips Hue lights. I know they've released some new ones with brighter outputs, but when I had all Philips Hue on my previous apartment, I didn't like that. It didn't feel light enough for me. I grew up in a very bright home, so I think this is might be some genetic thing or something, but like my father loves like to have all of the environments in the home be really bright when the lights are on, of course. And I'm also like that. Like I really hate having a meal in a dim lit room or in the dark. So it's just something that I don't like. Like I like the environment to be really bright. And of course you might be screaming, but how are you going to sleep and things like that? But yeah, at night I can like turn off some of the lights and things like that. So yeah, don't worry, I'm sleeping just fine.
And in general, that's something I've noticed as well, is that when you buy smart lights, like from Philips or any other company, like I've bought some smart lights from IKEA, for example, I've noticed that you usually have to make that trade-off around, do you want brightness or do you want colors? Because mm-hmm. I remember when I bought my lights that I had to choose, like if I only wanted shades of brightness, basically, like, you know, a certain color temperature, and then you can just make it brighter or dimmer, or I wanted like the full spectrum of colors, then those colored lights would be less bright in general. That's just something I've noticed.
Yeah, yeah. My architects probably thought I was a weirdo about how particular I was about the color temperature of the lamps. Personally, I like cooler lights, especially during the day, of course. So it's funny, right after I moved here, I was living with my father, and like I mentioned, he lights very bright lights and very cool lights, not like to the point where they're blue, but they look white. They don't look warm at all. So when I moved here, I got the apartment, I rented the apartment, and it was using the lamps that it came with, and they were a little bit warmer and they were quite dim. So I noticed that I would be feeling like going to bed at like 8 p.m. or like even before that, like 7 p.m. I was feeling super sleepy and kind of like I wanted to go to bed already. And I couldn't figure out what was going on until I changed the lamps for brighter and cooler lamps. So the whole thing about cool, bright lights change your sleep cycle is completely true, at least for me.
Yeah, I mean, light affects so much of our mood, I think. And yeah. I'm one of those people, like, from day to day, I can have so different preferences when it comes to the light, where sometimes I feel really productive in the evenings if I turn off the lights in the office and I just turn on dark mode on my Mac and I just sit there and code for like 3 or 4 hours, and I'm like super productive and like in the zone, and it's just like dark all around me. But that's just the environment I like for that. But then the next day I might feel the complete opposite, where I'm like you, I get a little bit sleepy and then I want to turn up the lights and I feel better that way. Sometimes I like to have the lights on during the day too, just to get some extra brightness, because, well, here so far north that I live, even like in the winter, even during the day, we don't get that much sunlight. Yeah. So then it can be great to have some artificial lighting to help out there. But yeah, I completely agree. Like the light really can affect your mood. And I've really started to notice that recently, where I can really like help myself out when it comes to getting in the right mood, depending on kind of what kind of lighting situation I have.
Yeah, and also why it's important to at night have like the sleep hygiene to go and turn down the lights a little bit. And that's why I have a lot of light strips here. Most of them are Hue light strips, and those have the full spectrum of colors and different warmth that you can set up. So if I want a dimly lit apartment with warmer lights, I can turn off the ceiling lamps and just leave the Philips Hue strips, and with a little bit of a warmer tone. So this whole detour here was to explain why I decided to have regular lights. And because I've decided to have regular lamps on the ceilings, that means that I would have to have some sort of smart switch in order to turn them on and off.
Because you can't just turn off the lights using a normal wall switch like, you know, most people do.
Like an animal.
Right.
That's actually a good point. That's very important as well. So that was one of the things I really wanted about my setup. I wanted to be able to just use the lights as regular lights, not just as smart lights. So the best thing about having the lights automated is not to individually control lights, at least that's how I mostly use things here. The best thing is being able to, when you go to bed at night, you just do the good night scene and it turns off everything that needs to be turned off. So you don't have to worry about, oh, did I leave the light on in the kitchen or something? Or when you leave the house, or when you want to watch a movie and you don't want to get up from the couch to turn off the lights, which...
To engage cinema mode.
Exactly, yeah. So in my case here, the switch is where I can turn off the lights in the kitchen / living room area are quite far away from the couch. And of course, there are places where they put like multiple places where you can control the same lights. That's another solution. But yeah, it's just convenient. And in order to achieve that, I got the Fibaro relay switches. I believe Fibaro is a Polish company, actually.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, something like that. I'm not entirely sure, but I remember they had a connection to a place you were connected to. So maybe Poland.
Either Sweden or Poland.
Yeah, or maybe Sweden. I don't know. But yeah, so I got those. And I did quite a bit of research back when I was deciding to get them, because I would need to get a bunch of them. And in fact, I got 19 of those relay switches, which is quite a lot. And you can look them up and do the math to how much I spent on these switches. And the way they work, they're this tiny little device, and they go inside the wall switch behind the regular light switch. And you connect the light switch to them, and you connect power and everything else, and the output, of course. And then you can control with both HomeKit, or you can also use the regular switch. So it's really good. The problem, though, is that these Fibaro switches, they are Bluetooth-based. And need I say more?
Based on our conversations for the past couple of years, I would say you probably don't need to say more. I think we've established fairly well the, as much as Bluetooth like kind of connects all of our devices and is very convenient and it's great that it exists, it's not the most reliable technology in the world.
Yeah, like, believe me, I'm a Bluetooth fanboy, if there is one, but the thing is, and it's not the fault of Bluetooth in this case, because like Bluetooth is limited in range and data rate and whatnot, but like, come on, it's just on or off. It's one bit of data. It's just one or zero. Of course, it's not, because all the encryption and whatever. But anyway,
you have to encrypt that byte a lot, so it turns into a, you know, 28-bit thing.
Yeah, so... the way HomeKit is supposed to work, and these Fibaro, they are MFI certified HomeKit relay switches. So the way HomeKit is supposed to work is you have a bunch of home hubs in your home. They're all connected to Wi-Fi. They're all set up with your iCloud account. And trust me, I do have a lot of them here. I have 2 Apple TVs. I have 2 OG HomePods. I have 7 HomePod minis and a bunch of iPads. And I have all of the home hubs here. All running the latest and greatest software, no betas on any of my home hubs. Any device that can be a home hub where I run beta software, I disable the home hub feature to prevent beta software from disturbing my home automation. And then Apple updated all of the things to whatever OS 15.1 earlier this year, or maybe later in 2021, and things just went downhill from there. So the thing I notice is when I'm trying to, and I've done a lot of debugging, like I've looked at sys diagnosis and filed feedbacks and did all of the things you're supposed to do. The way it's supposed to work is if I try to control, say I'm downstairs and I'm trying to control one of these switches that is upstairs, my iPhone can't connect to the switch over Bluetooth because it's too far. So the way it's supposed to work is my home app on my iPhone will connect to the home hub that's closest to the actual device that can talk to it, and then the home hub will connect to the device over Bluetooth and tell it to do whatever it's supposed to do. And for whatever reason, that just stopped working. And basically, that means that only the active home hub will connect to the devices, but the home app will always try to connect to the device directly before it does that. And that means that if the active home hub, so when you have a bunch of home hubs, there's always one that's the like primary one, the active one, and the other ones are on standby. If the active home hub is downstairs and I'm trying to control something upstairs, it's not going to connect, like it's not going to work. And that also means that any automations that were based on the state of these switches, so, oh, if I turn off the switch, then also turn off this Hue light strip or something, none of those would work either, because the home hub is not getting the signal from the switch. So basically, Apple did something to iOS, HomePod, OS, tvOS, whatever, that completely broke Bluetooth HomeKit devices, unless you are in a really small home or you have very few devices, I guess.
And do you think that this might be some kind of classic trade-off between security and privacy and convenience, where, you know, sometimes we see these features like being added where it's great for like privacy or security reasons because it's making the system more kind of locked down and more predictable and, you know, harder for malicious things to happen. But at the same time, it's also making it more limited in what you can do with it. Do you think this was one of those situations or not?
I think it might be. Definitely, like, even when it's working properly, the whole HomeKit over Bluetooth situation is not particularly great. I don't believe in Bluetooth low energy as a home automation technology in and of itself, as Apple uses it with HomeKit. I do believe in the Bluetooth low energy mesh technology, which you can think of it kind of like Zigbee, so where each node in the network can also relay messages to another node. That is a much more reliable solution if you're going to be using Bluetooth low energy. But in general, I don't think it's a good fit. And the way it works with HomeKit is there's a whole negotiation that has to go on for a connection to happen. So your home hubs are not going to be always connected over Bluetooth to your nodes, to your end devices. So if I want to send a command to one of these relay switches, there's a whole negotiation that has to happen. The actual low-level Bluetooth connection has to be opened, and then a session has to be established, and then the command can be sent, and then after a timeout, the session will be torn down, and the whole thing dies, and it has to do it all over again for the next command. And I can understand that for battery-powered devices, but like my HomePod minis are plugged into the wall. Mm-hmm. They're always plugged into the wall. There's no battery in the HomePod mini. And these devices are also always, they're like literally wired directly to mains power. So,
right.
I mean, I understand like you have to be energy efficient. I'm not saying that you should waste power just because you're plugged into mains. But like Bluetooth low energy, like low energy, it's right in the name. So it's not going to destroy or rank up your power bill because it's always connected or always doing something. So in any rate, like the gist of it is that Bluetooth low energy as a HomeKit control protocol, I don't believe in it anymore. And I will give it an exception if it's just for indication. So if you have some simple sensor, like I have a bunch of VocoLink sensors here. They are door and window sensors for like opening and closing when you have to check if you have a door or window open or closed. And I have automations that trigger based on those as well. And those work great because they're basically just sending a little ping to let something know that, oh, this door has been opened or closed. So because they are so simple and you're not actively controlling them in any way, they are fairly reliable. So for those devices, I think it's fine. Like, I think it works. But if it's anything that you actually want to control, I would steer away and run from anything that's HomeKit that uses Bluetooth low energy.
Right. And just going back a second there to what you were talking about regarding energy efficiency, and I completely agree with you that, of course, we should try to build all of our systems, like the code that we write in our applications as well, like as energy efficient as we possibly can. Like, in fact, I'm probably going to talk about this more maybe on the next episode or in a few weeks, but I've been doing even more work on my Swift UI-based game, not to take over the HomeKit conversation here with the game development corner, but I've been able to now not only make the game run like with a smooth frame rate, but also actually make it more energy efficient. Because when you're running it on the Mac, for example, you can see like your energy efficiency score as you're running in Xcode. And for a while, like I was making things run really smooth, but then the energy usage was high. So then my next challenge was like, okay, how can I make this even more efficient, still with that smooth frame rate, but then make it go down to low instead? Like, wouldn't that be cool if I can both have great performance and low energy usage? Like, that for me is like, that's the ideal. But at the same time, to your point, like when you are working with a system that is like constantly connected and you have other means for reducing the energy usage, then perhaps you don't have to be as aggressive when it comes to things like throttling and those kinds of measures that are more kind of well-suited for a more mobile kind of battery-driven environment where you really have constraints around kind of power draw. And I think we've seen this in Apple's operating systems in general, where it's like we've talked about the widgets on the Mac, where it's like you're running in this completely different environment on the Mac where you have more power available, you have more, like not just power in terms of like actual electricity, but also like power in terms of what the Mac can do. And still like the widgets become as constrained as on iOS because they're sharing that kind of same system logic. And perhaps this is another one of those instances where perhaps the system was optimized for mobile, but now you're in this different environment and perhaps the system should be slightly tweaked or adapt to make it work better in that environment.
Yeah, and to be completely fair to Apple, and I have used the widgets in the conversation as an example to illustrate the point about the HomePod Mini and wall switch power savings. But to be completely fair to Apple, they have improved things significantly on macOS. And that's why with AirBuddy 2.5, for instance, I was able to make the widget update way more frequently. Mm-hmm. So props to them for making it better. But the thing I've decided to do here is, as usual, throw money and work at the problem. In this case, it requires a bit of work. Like I could definitely hire like the same person who did all of the electrics here to also do the swapping of the switches, but I've decided to do it myself in this case because it's everything is already installed and prepared for it, so it's not that much work. Of course, disclaimer, do not mess with mains things, like things that are connected to mains electricity. It's really dangerous. I feel confident doing it because I've grown up in a house where my dad used to repair electronics, so he taught us about like safety with electricity. And of course, when I'm doing things here, I always turn off the breakers, and I have one of those testing things that you can point to a wire and it will tell you if there's electricity flowing in the wire. So I take all of the safety precautions, and if you don't feel confident doing this sort of thing, please don't. Like, you can get killed doing this stuff. So yeah, be careful.
Yeah, I'm not touching anything that has to do with electricity. I'm the complete opposite of you, right? Like, I haven't had that kind of training, and I'm not used to it. So if there's any work that needs to be done in the house, like, I can change a light bulb. But if there's any other kind of electricity work that needs to be done in the house, I usually ask someone to help out because, yeah, I just don't feel comfortable doing that. And I think that's important, like, knowing your own limits, right? And knowing what is safe for you to do versus not. And I think that's an important point as well.
Yeah, definitely. So for simple things, like, for me, this is simple because I have experience basically doing this sort of thing, and I also have a lot of equipment here for the stuff I do with electronics, so I have testing equipment and things that I can use to ensure that everything is properly installed and there are no shorts or things like that. So yeah, if you don't feel confident, don't do it. It's definitely safer that way. So the product I'm replacing them with, when I was doing my research initially, I found a lot of these relay-type products for HomeKit, and the only one that was MFI certified, that was like an official product that I could find back then, was the Fibaro one. And there's also the thing, I live in Brazil, so I had to find something that I could source here. It was right in the midst of the height of the pandemic, where it was very hard to actually get something imported into the country, so things would take a really long time. And of course, I was both on a budget and I had a fixed schedule where I had to have these things ready for the people who were doing the installation.
Yeah, it's also hard to move in without lights, right?
Definitely. So back then, I didn't want to go with anything else, and I found a bunch of these devices that are not HomeKit certified, but they are very hackable. And I was under a different mindset back then, where I didn't want my home automation setup to be a hacking project for me. Like, I wanted it to be products. I wanted it to be off-the-shelf stuff that I can buy, like consumer-grade products that I can just set up and use. And that was a mistake, because the consumer grade products that you can just set up and use, they are not very good right now. And I think things might change with Thread and Matter and all of the good stuff that's been happening in that market. But right now, if you want to have a lot of home automation stuff and you want everything to work, you cannot expect to just buy stuff off the shelf, set it up as per the manufacturer's instructions, and get things to work reliably. That's just not a realistic expectation in 2022, and it should not have been my expectation in 2021. So I bought the Shelly 2.5. This is a device that's very similar in shape to the Fibaro one. I think it's slightly smaller. It's not as pretty as the Fibaro one, but it's hidden in the wall, so it doesn't really matter. I'm not sure where this company is from. Like, they have offices in Germany and the US, apparently, so maybe it's a German company or something. But these devices, basically, off the shelf, the way it works is it opens up a Wi-Fi hotspot and you connect to it and you go to your browser like at 192.whatever.whatever, and it's like a little web server running.
Oh, so it's like setting up a router.
Yeah, exactly. But the good thing about this device, which can also be a bad thing, but in this case, the good thing about this device is that it's hackable. So there's an open source firmware for the Shelly, and they have the Shelly 2.5, which is the ones I have installed so far. So the Shelly 2.5, it has two outputs and two switch inputs, so you can control basically two points of light with a single device. So in every place where I have double switches here, I've installed this one, and I've ordered the Shelly 1, which is the one that has only one channel, that I'm going to install where I only need one channel, but those haven't arrived yet. And so what you do is basically you go to this web server that it opens up after you've connected to its Wi-Fi hotspot, and you connect it to your actual Wi-Fi network by entering the credentials, which feels super iffy to do on like a device like this. But I have pi holes here, so I can monitor whatever it's doing on my network. And then you basically like take the URL in your browser and you put /OTA URL equals and the URL to a zip file sitting on a server somewhere from some random person, and it installs this firmware that has HomeKit support. But I'm saying this because it is iffy, but like the whole firmware is open source. You can compile it yourself if you want to. There's like SHA hashes for everything. So basically, this is stuff for people who are hackers or programmers or have some knowledge of networks and whatnot.
Enthusiasts, you could say.
Yeah, enthusiasts, hobbyists, DIY people. So basically, that's what I've done. I've set up, I think, like 3 or 4 of them so far, and they work perfectly.
That's great. It must have been also a fun project. Like, the more time goes on and the more I now live in my own apartment that I own, the more I feel motivated to do these DIY projects, like do it yourself. Like, it's really cool when you do something, even if it's small. Like, I just put up some shelves, or I was constructing a rail for a curtain that I had to like custom cut to fit the place, and, you know, put the curtain up, making it really smooth and level and everything. Like, it was a whole project, because I'm not very good with this kind of practical building. I'm very good at building software, but not like when it comes to building practical real life things. I have still a lot to learn. I mean, I have a lot to learn about software too, but you get the point. It's really motivating. Like, when you've done that little project, even if it's like a small thing and you maybe spend a day on it, then you look at it and you're like, I made this. Like, it just feels good. So I can totally understand if it, like, after you've done this now, like every time you change your lighting or you flip a switch, you're like, I kind of built this.
Yeah, exactly. And this device, as far as I can see, it's based on an ESP microcontroller, maybe the ESP32 or something similar. So it means that it's a microcontroller that I'm actually familiar with. So if I want to like write my own firmware for it, I definitely can. I may want to try that out sometime, because I can see how I could improve it. And one aspect of this device that I liked more than the Fibaro one is, so with the Fibaro one, when, let's say I have a light switch and the light switch on the wall is in the off position, but then I turn on the light using HomeKit. For me to turn off the light with the Fibaro switch using the actual switch on the wall, I would have to flip it to the on position and flip it again to the off position because it was out of sync with the actual state of the light.
Right.
But with the Shelly, I can configure it to change the state of the light on the edge of the signals, not just like, oh, if the input is on, then the light is on. If the input is off, then the light is off. So basically what this means now is whenever I flip a switch on the wall, it will change the state of the light to the opposite state it's currently in. So there's no more double flipping of switches, which is also really good for usability when you have people around that are not familiar with this stuff, which is a big point as well of why I like to have this setup that's not like entirely based on home automation. For people who don't know that it's all automated, they don't even know. Like, they just use the switch as they normally would. While at my previous place where there were normal light switches on the walls and I had my Philips Hue lamps, I had to like tape over the light switches on the wall because if you turn them off, then the lamp goes offline. And yeah, basically it doesn't work very well. So I'm feeling very confident about this new setup. And yeah, like you mentioned, it's really fun to do these little home improvement things by yourself. And one of my favorite things is I set up reservations on my Eero network here in such a way where all of the Shelly devices, they occupy a contiguous section of IP addresses. So like the first one is 150, the second one is 151, and so on. And I'm so happy about that.
Yeah, it seems really nice. Like, seems like you created a very, very nice setup, which again is like you built it, like not the actual components from scratch, but you assembled it yourself and seems to have created a really nice structure. And I completely agree also with like trying to strike a nice balance between kind of the usability of physical switches with the home setup. Like, I currently only have these kinds of lights where it's the all of the smartness is in the actual light bulb. And then you do have that problem where if someone flips the switch off, which is very often me, I do it myself, then the smartness doesn't work anymore. And then after a while, you kind of like, I have some smart lights here in my house, which I haven't controlled using like HomeKit for 6 months because I've just been, I just hit the switch, you know?
Yeah,
and yeah, that's what happens. So yeah, I think it seems like a really nice setup. Maybe if you come visit me, Rambo, at some point in the future, maybe you can redo my apartment as well.
I must say, even though it is kind of scary if you're not familiar with it, but I do find the actual work of doing the installation quite relaxing, like therapeutic in some sense. Like it's just, oh, connect this wire here, this other wire there, and oh, this wire has to go through this little tube here. It's so much more simple than the complexities of our day-to-day work, and it's also a manual type of thing, and it doesn't require like artistic skills. It's more of a technical thing. So it's like I'm actually finding the process of doing the switch myself quite therapeutic.
Yeah, I mean, it's like working with your hands, kind of, right? Like, yeah, you know, you're doing something with your hands that is not typing on a keyboard can be super relaxing. Like, it's I completely agree with that. And we've been talking about doing like computer-free weekends and things like that. And that's what I spend a lot of my time on. I spend time on cooking and gardening when it's not freezing outside. You know, home renovation stuff. And it's just really neat to do something that is just completely analog. It's not something that you're doing on the computer.
You mentioned freezing outside. I have the opposite problem here. I've been postponing changing the switch that controls the pool motors because it's so hot outside and I don't want to burn in the sun.
Well, Rambo, I have a hard time being sympathetic for that problem right now. I just want more heat, want more spring to come and summer to come. So, but yeah, I know. It's like too much sun is also not great, right? You want that nice middle ground, that nice balance.
Yeah.
All right. So that's going to be it for this week's episode of Stack Trace. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. And thanks so much to Sentry for sponsoring this episode. And we will talk to you again next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.